understand it.
Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode number 112, The Invention of the Future. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. We are very pleased to have with us in the studio today, Bruno Carvalho. Bruno is a professor at Harvard University, where he teaches courses on cities. And the book, as the title of our show implies, is The Invention of the Future, A History of Cities in the Modern World. Bruno, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we, of course, are very well steeped in most of the standard narratives about urban planning and how people tend to think of how we should redesign cities. We know some of the big stories around, or we think we know some of the big stories around people like Baron von Haussmann and Ebenezer Howard and a few other names that will be familiar to most in the urban planning camps. But there's a lot of other individuals and stories in this book that I certainly hadn't heard before. And so I suspect our broader audience might not have either. So I guess what I wanted to start with was, how did you select some of the people whose future narratives you felt would be important to expose? And why did you choose the time period that you cover, which goes back to, if I'm not mistaken, the Lisbon earthquake of 1755? Why does that stand to you as a sort of the beginning of the modern city?
Yeah. So I try to tell a story about when humans began to expect that the future might be radically different from the present and the past on this earth, right? So the 18th century is important to that because, as a rule, more or less people imagine that the future was shaped by supernatural forces or the divine, right? So in the 18th century, these sort of ideas begin to coalesce, especially among lettered people in Europe, that the future is indeed something that we as humans can build. We can do that, you know, here on Earth. And cities become the major expression of that, right? So Lisbon's earthquake essentially presents an opportunity for, a planner with capital P, though, of course, prior to the discipline coalescing, by the name of Pombal, who was very familiar with Enlightenment ideas. He'd spent time in Vienna and London, and he was given, you know, unusual powers for someone in his position to essentially rebuild the city, and he did that along these sort of rational secular lines. So the story more or less begins there. This, of course, becomes a much bigger and eventually a global story. And as I tell it, I try to place some of these very well-known individuals and planners, like the ones you mentioned, you know, Haussmann and Howard, within a broader story, right? So it tries to tell the story of how some of these figures shaped and tried to shape urbanization, and how essentially people experienced these changes from below.
Well, it's always been kind of a fun game to play, looking back on what people thought the future would be and kind of comparing that to where we actually got to. And usually it's fairly disappointing because we haven't advanced nearly as far as people thought we might. But it's always also interesting to look at what people don't think will change or that they didn't take account of. In some of the future visions that you describe, what were the things that you thought were most striking about these past visions of the future, is the best way to put it? Things that people thought would change based on the prevalent or most interesting technological or societal developments, you know, versus other strands that may have been emerging in society, but maybe it wasn't polite to talk about yet. It might have been dangerous to talk about in certain circumstances. You know, it sort of seems like in a lot of cases, technological anticipation was well ahead of social anticipation.
No, I think that's a good way to put it. So yes, obviously there's all kinds of moments in this book where the future does not pan out as people expected that it did. I mean, I'm you know, careful not to tell a story of sort of gotchas. You know, look at how wrong we always get it, but it does emerge from looking back in the past 300 years or so, that almost as a rule, reasonable expectations tend to underestimate the range of potential outcomes. that's not an argument for us to, you know, become unreasonable in our predictions. It's basically an argument for just how difficult it is to sort of account for all of the variables involved in urbanization, right? And it tends to be things that escape our immediate sight that matter, especially in retrospect. There's this incredible image. So the book has 60 illustrations. There's this incredible images from the 1820s of how people were imagining changes in transit. And, you know, by then balloons were already around. So people imagine, why not having these sort of flying, you know, naval-like contraptions for warfare and, you know, for transporting the masses and so on, pneumatic tubes. And what's missing is the one that was really about to change the world as people in the 1820s knew it, which was the train. And it's kind of amazing how often that happens. This isn't something I entered this project knowing, but it became very clear spending time with the primary sources that nobody really saw the car, the victory of the car coming. Most planners, science fiction, you name it, tended to imagine that the future of transit was in collective vehicles, right? And yet, well, here we are. So to stick closer to some of what you alluded to in your question, the other kind of recurrent pattern is that people tend to imagine that their own cultural tastes will endure. So, you know, they might imagine a future where the way we govern ourselves is completely different, where our built fabric is completely different, but where people are listening to the same kinds of music. Right? So there's one example of an early utopia where people are imagining these sort of contraptions that are carrying sound from, you know, theater downtown into individual homes, but of course they're still listening to Bach, right? They're not imagining these tastes will change. The other sort of very consistent example is in gender relations. People have a very, very hard time imagining that those would change. And again, here we are.
I want to build up the transit example for a moment there, because I was curious if you sort of see a grand arc or theory of change in urban form as related to that. I mean, obviously, it's interesting that, you know, you have Carlos Moreno at the Sorbonne today advocating for the 15-minute city inside of Haussmannian in Paris. But then you also have like the concept of Marchetti's constant, you know, this idea that humans travel 30 minutes and as transportation technology changed, urban form evolved. I'm curious how you see that interplay with other elements. Like, is there a grand evolutionary sweep of urbanity as these elements sort of play out there, or is it still more fragmented? I'm curious, like, your thoughts on, you know, human agency and the planner's role versus these larger tectonic, technological and social forces that drive it.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And the cop-out would be, you know, ask me again in about 500 years when we've had enough history. And the reason I say that is because the victory of the car is in a way so improbable, and it's hard for us to sort of recover the extent to which it is so, because it was such an overwhelming victory in the 1950s in the United States and then elsewhere since. And I say that because, the planners you mentioned are in many ways sort of trying to unwind this victory, because it's so irrational from the perspective of, you know, effective urban transit, right? I mean, cars, as we know, are wonderful if not a lot of people are using them, right? So unlike other forms of transit, the more people use cars, the worse it is for everybody. Whereas the more people ride trains, the best it is, you know, better off we are for everybody. And I really came around to concluding, against my own intuitions coming into this project, that you could take away all of the traditions of modernist planners who were very enthusiastic about the car. You could take them away from history and we would end up more or less where we did. Because again, the conditions that allowed for that were so unique historically. And that's why I don't think we can sort of make any sweeping claims about, you know, the rhythms of history. And just to name a few, you know, the timing. Cars had this great competitive advantage relative to streetcars, that they used public ways without having to pay for them, right? So streetcars were usually private companies, but they were regulated. Whereas parking, there were sort of no rules around it. So you got this freebie. And by the time that, you know, lawmakers and civil society tried to catch up, this was too entrenched. That wasn't enough, right? Even then, they're still have a very hard time in cities competing with other modes of transportation. To me, it really took the imperative to sort of re-gear U.S. wartime productive capacity after World War II, right? And the book tells a story. I mean, it tells a story in many, many ways, and it, you know, including the Jetsons and culture narratives and so on. But I think the sine qua non, like that without which you don't get what we got, was the regearing industrial capacity. So again, the book tells that story in all kinds of ways, including, and I think hopefully, you know, more excitingly for a lot of the listeners, advertisements. So concrete, aluminum, tire, oil companies that were essentially advertising suburbia, you know, anywhere you cared to look. And yeah, that's of course how we kept the economy chugging along after the war in this country.
So where do you net out ultimately on the role of the grand planners in this? Because it's very interesting, some of the examples, the grid of Manhattan is the one that stands out to me in many ways, because if we just transpose it to the rough present, you know, there, and we can discuss this more in detail, we have like NEOM's The Line at one end, a sort of hyper modern technological version of Arcosanti by Soleri is like the planner's ultimate creation. But the grid is another version where, like, I've had conversations with, you know, the Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Romer, for example, and his idea of charter cities or building cities from scratch. And the economists will tell you, it doesn't matter what you build, it doesn't matter what you plan, just put down a basic grid, put down some basic parameters, and then people will go from there. And then also, like, informality plays into that too. The vast majority of global urbanism is completely informal. So I'm curious, like, you know, were the planners fighting against, like, this downfall from the car, the fall from heaven? Are they overweening in their desire? I'm curious if your own mind, the book has a villain in that regard.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great question. And I mean, the book and the preface sort of lays this out, and then it becomes clear in the epilogue. I mean, the argument that I arrive at is that we would do well to, you know, keep planning, again, keep predicting, even if we get it wrong, but not being too possessive about what planning and planners can do, right? You know, the grid, so one of the ways that I put it is that urban design, architecture, planning, it shows, but you can't really control what you tell, right? So a skyscraper might signify prosperity or dystopia, and glass might signify surveillance or transparency, and it kind of really depends on the specifics. The grid is a perfect example of that, right? The grid in ancient China had a logic very different from the grid for the Romans, right? So as one historian, Sam Edgerton, put it, the Greek for the Romans was centrifugal. For ancient China, it was centripetal, right? The places where you had to be important enough to access were at the center, and it sort of drew you in if you could access them, right? Whereas for the Romans, it was just sort of a basic blueprint through which you would sort of reproduce the expansion logics, right? The Cardo, the Decuman, the military barracks, and expanded outwards from that and so on. You know, and then in the more Western tradition, straight line becomes equated with moral rectitude, right? So it's the sort of privileged form for civilization and progress and so on. The car changes that. Sinuous layouts in, you know, the Olmsted suburbs and Riverside and so on, they then become the kind of the forms of power, because then you can slow down cars in residential neighborhoods, it's easier to drive without having to start, you know, reduce intersections and so on and so forth. So I sort of do tend to agree that those forms matter to the extent that you meet some basic conditions, you know, accessibility, density. I mean, it depends on what you're going for. The New York case is pretty extraordinary, because it's in, I think, and I mean, I argue this in the book, and if any listeners, you know, think this is wrong, I'd love to hear from them. It seems like it's the first time that the grid was used without a program at all. And you still have that in New York today, right? If you walk around Manhattan and you ask people where its center is, you're going to get all kinds of different answers, right? And most other places with grids, you sort of look at them and you know where power is located, whatever, however that power might be constituted. And its success, to a great degree, I think, owes to this just lack of prescription, right? The commissioners, they basically kind of phoned it in. I mean, they were busy with all kinds of other stuff, so they did the most basic thing you could do to the island. Nobody thought this thing was going to get settled. You know, Harlem was going to get settled anytime soon. It was sort of this running joke at the time. Of course, they didn't know the Erie Canal was right around the corner and the city would soon boom. And of course, they didn't know that this grid was going to work so well because of the vertical grid and the skyscraper. But anyway, yeah, what I landed on is that planning is very, very important. We have to hold on to it, but we should be very careful about being possessive about the future. That tends to not work very well.
Yeah, it does sort of seem like there's a continuing theme of conflict, you know, throughout the centuries, really, that are depicted in the book, where the desires of the state, you know, to create triumphal ways to quell riots or discourage protest or make way for military vehicles, all of which were characteristics of certainly the Haussmann plan. But one of the most interesting contrasts that you show actually does come from an early photograph, which I think took place during the Paris Commune, when the city had a sort of proto-socialist government that rebelled against the, was it now the Third Napoleonic Empire? And there's quite a bit of juxtaposition just in this one shot, where Haussmann had had his way at that point, right? He had created the boulevards. You saw the classic Parisian facade on one half of the photo in the background. And then in the foreground, you've got the barricades, despite all attempts to guard against this type of thing. And then in the other part of the photo, in the rear, you've got an advertisement that's pitched toward the working man. You know, it's some kind of gadgets that the working man would find useful. And then the working man, of course, and his representatives are out in the streets. So that's quite a juxtaposition. Are there other aspects, are there other instances of master planning where you have seen that that potent of a juxtaposition? You know, I guess maybe you think of something like Occupy Wall Street, but that doesn't quite capture it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, there's a lot there. I mean, those are great questions. So one of the arcs in the book, and one of the things that it traces, is sort of like the scale at which people imagine the future. So to go back to something else that we were just discussing, since we didn't mention this aspect of it, in a way, the Highway Act in the 50s in the US and the car, that's a moment where planning no longer happens at the urban or the municipal or the metropolitan scale, but rather at a much, much sort of larger scale. And again, I think that's another condition for the victory of the car is power moving from cities to nation states, which is something else we take for granted, but is pretty much a 20th century story, right? A lot of historians will argue that 19th century cities were more powerful than government at other scales, right? They could sort of control their trade policies, right? They could do a whole lot more than they can do now. So that moment of the Paris Commune is, in a way, a moment where the nation state imposes its will on the city as a scale of governance and sovereignty, right? So people thought that you could still pull that off. Like, we're gonna call, you know, we're gonna claim that we're independent, and the republic be damned. And this is a moment of transition from the Second Empire of Osman to a very conservative republic. And then picture, yeah.
And you can still see the pattern of the commune today in like Parisian voting.
That's
patterns.
Right.
Like, the commune voting, never disappeared.
Yep.
It's the exactly
east,
there.
Yeah, the east votes to the left. The west votes to the right. Yeah, so you have these continuities. You have all these ruptures, right? So you have all these ways in which one of the visions for the Haussmannian plans was to segregate the city along social lines. The history of planning is a history of the unintended, for good and for bad. In this case, for good, the boulevards were occupied by the masses. To Hausmann's credit, I mean, Hausmann gets, you know, a very bad rap in urban history, but they did try to contemplate all kinds of you know, beautiful parks for the masses too, and so on. But yeah, the commune was at a moment after that, after this sort of dream had really collapsed, right? The Germans had you know, this is the moment of the Franco-Prussian War, which the Prussians won. Some of these parks for the masses, you know, people ended up eating the elephants or the giraffes during German siege. The one thing, this photo is in the reading of it is one of, I think, to me, the more powerful moments in this history and in the book, because there you really have the competing futures from the perspective of working classes, as you so well put it, right? A future as a citizen in a republic where you and not some emperor is under control of your destiny. And then this other one that had a very magnetic power and appeal to the working classes too, which was, the advertisement reads, to the worker, novelties. And, you know, a lot of individuals were conflicted, and this, of course, split the working classes too. Not everyone wanted the same things, as so often happens.
You know, the return to the discussion of the automobile, which, you know, clearly can't be discounted. I'm thinking also of, you know, the attempts of, as we graduated from the grid, which, of course, is the concept of gridlock didn't really come about until the plan of New York was completely clogged with automobiles. And of course, now to try to mitigate against that 40, 50 years too late is the congestion pricing scheme as a planning response. But in the middle, you have an attempt to kind of merge these instincts of planning for the masses, recreation for the masses, with the emergence of the automobile, which was the parkway system that Robert Moses. And I've now found out that there was a landscape architecture firm, which is very underreported, Park and Rapuano. You know, the people who actually executed, you know, Moses' plans. Do you think that there was, I mean, in some ways that the parkway system was a great anticipation of how much people would attach themselves to the automobile as an object of importance in their lives, but it also under-anticipated just how much capacity would be required to move cars around. All of those classic parkways, the Sawmill River Parkway, et cetera, that run throughout, you know, Westchester and Long Island, are notoriously undersized. Well, in fact, they were purposefully, right, undersized for trucks, because the idea was that they would not be commercial, that they would be partially recreational. But they're pretty much they're undersized for the kind of commuting capacities that we now have to deal with. Do you regard that the execution of the Moses Parkway plan to be an under anticipation of the future, or is it kind of like a handmaiden to the future from the perspective of the 1920s, you know, what we knew about cars at the time?
Right. So it belonged to this earlier moment where the idea of cars was that they could take you out of the city and into the countryside, right? Early suburbs come from that same kind of you know, desire and impulse. And of course, we have to remember how miserable cities were in the 19th century and really through the 20s, right? They were more polluted, they were louder, we didn't have modern medicine. So the logic of that first iteration of parkways was recreational. And that's how cars were selling, right, into the 10s and 20s. They were much more appealing as a way to leave the city than as a way through which to move inside the city. The problem of capacity is not just transit and mobility, it's mostly storage, right? Cars spend most of their time, at least, you know, private cars, not moving around, right? They take up fabulous amounts of space. That's something that no one really anticipated in the 20s and the 30s. You know, in a way, the story in the 50s and 60s is the raising of downtowns to transform it into surface lots to sort of accommodate uses of cars that are no longer just along the parkway model of sort of recreation, but are rather for commuting. So it becomes a much, much larger problem that, again, wasn't anticipated. But the reason that you could still pull this off in Moses's New York, I think to a more successful extent than elsewhere, was something else that happened in between, which was the subway. So New York and Paris and Barcelona and many of the cities that, you know, now seem to have a better transit housing equilibrium had the great fortune of absorbing some of those pressures through underground mobility systems. Cities that didn't suffered very different fates.
Yeah, it does almost seem like a fluke at this point in terms of the ones that were able to actually build out those systems in the decades before the car emerged and sort of veered it in a different direction.
Yeah. Oh. And I will say just to add to that list of very specific conditions that, you know, led us where we are, more or less anywhere. I mean, there's this incredible postcard of sort of Baldwinville, Massachusetts, right? So these small towns throughout the U.S. really thought that the Manhattan model was their future too, right? So compact downtowns with mass transit. And there were all kinds of plans to do that, including expanding subway systems, which were shelved in World War I. And then as they were starting to come out of the shelf, the Great Depression hits, and then World War II hits, and then the rest is.
Historical materialism is a hell of a drug. I want to ask, to veer this off in a different direction. So listeners have probably heard this story before, but I'll tell it again and link together. So in 2023, Dan and I are sitting in Venice at the Neon Pavilion, and they have Sir Peter Cook of Archigram and his grand visions. And Sir Peter Cook is asked, who by the way is on the payroll of Neon, but is asked how he expects will happen with the line. And being in his naughty boy persona, he basically predicts that they'll build the first segment at its proper height, and then eventually future segments will get smaller and smaller and smaller until they eventually give up, and at that moment slums will appear. And the crowd sort of gasped that he would actually say this, and I was shocked because he literally described the trajectory of Brasilia. You can draw a straight line, so to speak, from the utopianness of Costa and Niedermeyer to the line in that regard. And in both cases, they were efforts to invent the future. Kubitschek, the president of Brazil, liked to say that they were going to do 50 years of progress in five, and then he was overthrown in a military coup. And then, of course, the Crown Prince, MBS, is, you know, trying to do Vision 30. And, like, the city itself is the machine for inventing the future, or at least as envisioned. That's part one of my question. The other part is, though, and it goes back to the core of your book, is that so many urbanist heroes today and in the past, like, reject the idea that you can't invent the future at all. Like, you look at, you know, you look at Moreno trying to do sort of an urban pastoralism with the 15-minute city. Jan Gehl in Copenhagen, which is, again, this small scale, you cannot improve it. And the new urbanists in America. Andres Duany has pointed out that people turned against demolishing buildings and replacing them because they lost faith in the future that you could actually do a better job in the future. So how do you tie those together? Can you actually invent a new urban future? They believed that it was the machine for doing so, but now it seems like we've completely lost faith that we can do any better than the forms that we were perfected before the automobile.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question. And, you know, I'm giving long answers because these are such great, rich, rich questions. So, I mean, where do we even begin? So one of the arguments in the book is that we should be careful about, learning lessons from history, which is someone who makes a living by studying the past isn't really something I'm supposed to say, but what I mean by that is that from a lot of the failures of top-down planning, we sort of concluded, or we developed this intuition that top-down approaches are necessarily authoritarian and bottom-up approaches are necessarily democratic. And that's just simply not true.
Seeing like a state, James C. Scott, this is received wisdom now, like seeing like a state in its analysis of Brasilia, the modernist city by Holsten, et cetera. Yeah,
exactly. So the last case study in the book is Lagos, which is a city to which in a matter of weeks, as many people moved to as lived in Lisbon, which was the third largest city in Europe when the book opens, right? More people live in metropolitan Lagos today than in the entire United States when the commissioners plan was laid out. You are not going to fix the problems of this city without top-down coordination. You cannot build a sewage system at this point without top-down approaches, right? You cannot achieve democratic, egalitarian aims without top-down coordination. And then conversely, as we've learned in the past few decades in this country, you know, grassroots, bottom-up, activism can be extraordinarily anti-democratic, right? We have that with all kinds of, you know, NIMBYism and ways in which people, you know, weaponize community participation to oppose housing or any kind of changes to the built fabric. And I say changes to the built fabric because we usually think of this as opposition to change, but change is the norm. You don't not get change in a city. So when you don't change, when you freeze the built fabric, you're going to get change. Demographic change, economic change, social change, and so on and so forth, right? I argue in this book that we should sort of recover, we must recover the large scales of, planning in its heyday. I think a lot of planners agree. It's a bit of a tragedy that this happens in a moment where planners are just simply not particularly powerful, especially in the Western world. This idea of the self-built as the future, absolutely, that's the story of Brasilia. You know, part of what happened, Brasilia's in the book too. It's a city I lived in. I lived in its outskirts. I didn't even know about any of these sort of utopian technocratic dreams until I became a scholar. The city I lived in was, the futures were still religious millenarian. It was a whole different ballgame.
Could you touch upon Brasilia just for a moment, explain how you lived there? Because I think because most people in their mind only know the pilot plan and they don't really understand that Brasilia is multiple different cities there for a second there. Like Brasilia has unplanned cities, like the worker housing, the slums predated the pilot plan, which I think we should have learned from. Yeah.
And I barely even knew the pilot plan was a thing. It's sort of a place you took the bus through, here and there. So just for listeners who aren't familiar with this history, a lot of the laborers who came from Brazil's northeast, which is the lowest income parts of the country, the plan is that they'd return, but this region was afflicted with droughts at this period, so a lot of people stuck around because of that and for all kinds of other reasons. I think that it's a fact rather than a prediction to say that the self-built is the future of cities. I mean, it is the most common mode of growth of urbanization today. I try to, this is very present in the book. I mean, one way to think of it is that you can think of a progression in parts of the world. You know, if we take a city like Paris, for example, where you go from people as infrastructure, peddlers in cities with slavery, someone is carrying your pee and your poop somewhere to throw it out and so on, right? So people as infrastructure. And then we, after planning and the grid and so on, we have infrastructure before people, right? You sort of the insider trading version of urbanization, right? You extend concessions, somebody learns about it ahead of time, they buy land on the cheap, this is announced, value goes up, they flip it and so on. And that's sort of the engine of urbanization in most of Western Europe and the North Atlantic. And then you have that's so successful and cities become such magnets that you have people before infrastructure. You have growth that planning cannot accommodate and people simply try to make do with the best of their abilities, right? And then you have more recently infrastructure without people, the Internet of Things and so on and so forth. So all four of those dynamics coexist in any given mega city in the world today, especially in the global south, right? So in a way, all four of these are simultaneously the future. It just depends on where and how you're looking, is how I would put it.
Yeah, it's wild to think that that's an interesting perspective. It's wild to think that we are living in multiple parallel futures and those futures overlap depending on where you are.
Yeah, and the same person can go through them within the same day, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say I don't think that's unusual at all. Number one, Dan, I hang out with futurists, so like think about that all the time. But two, I mean, I think it's also to your point there. I mean, if you end with Legos, you know, the United Nations just did like basically the decade update on their urbanization projections, and Jakarta has leapfrogged based on the way they did the stats to be the largest city in the world. And I'm familiar with, I think, the Indonesian word desakota, which is like, you know, their form of urbanism, which I've seen, which is like skyscraper, empty lot rice paddy, horrendous, like sprawl down to that level here. And that's the urban form of the world. It's beyond planning. It's something else completely. Well, I guess my question then, Bruno, is like, to your point then is can we invent the future again? What is that urban form? Because at the same time, you know, the smartphone is the most important mobility technology now, its coordination capabilities and what comes after that. And we're also seeing this burgeoning, this is something I follow closely, urban robotics, the form of delivery bots on streetscape. And we see, you know, that mobility in cities is defined by access too. Stuff comes to people. We also see the renewed push into drone technology, you know, of delivering things. China's made a big push in its urban cities and its countryside. And then lurking above it all, which terrifies me as an urbanist, is the sort of Sikorsky dream of urban air mobility, the idea that you live at scales of hundreds of miles, I mean, sprawl at scales we can never imagine. What would you survey as like the next keystone technology or breakthrough that will give us another urban form?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've already brilliantly answered your own question, which is, of course, we can and must and do constantly invent and reinvent our futures, right? The key there is the our part. Right. I think from if you take you know, sort of a secular mindset as a given, then the future is a necessity. Right. The future is not, it's not given. Right. It's not imposed by the divine and so on and so forth, which is another, you know, the book starts with an imagination outside of that. But of course, that stays there, doesn't go anywhere. And as I argue, it in fact informs a lot of secular imaginations, right? You know, the planner as savior, you know, in the 1920s and 30s has a sort of very Christian structure to how they approach the city. There's a telos. You can fix problems into prosperity and they will offer salvation, right? So it's sort of the planner as master and God and so on. But if you have a secular mindset, you know, your destiny isn't assigned. Right, it's there for you to make and remake, and your capacity and your autonomy to do that is, of course, contingent on all kinds of variables, you know, class, gender, race, depending on who and where and what you are, and so on. But it is necessarily open-ended, right? And that's, of course, the great promise of cities. I mean, as I put it in the book, in an aristocratic or you know, society oriented around chattel slavery or both at the same time. Your destiny is assigned to you, right? You're born an aristocrat, you die an aristocrat. You know, if your father is fixes shoes, that's kind of probably what you're gonna. And the premise of cities is that you move to them because your destiny isn't assigned prior to that, right? Because you can be more than whatever script is assigned to you at birth in the village you come from, and so on. And I do think that dream is very much alive. I mean, people still move to cities because they think that in cities they can invent and reinvent their futures. What planning does with that is another question, right? So if the hour there is planning, we're seeing all kinds of exciting, successful things happening in European cities that are sort of reclaiming spaces for you know, walkability and so on, and East Asian cities. You know, Tokyo is a city that's an engine of futures and, you know, has figured out how to fix its housing problems in ways that will hopefully inspire cities in the Western world. Vienna, in a, you know, less market, more state-led way is, you know, doing all kinds of things that are clearly working that, again, planners in this country, I think, should pay attention to, subsidizing, not demand, but supply, right? And increasing their housing supply and, allowing for other futures in that way, right? Because that's, I mean, another argument I would make is that the range and the possibilities of futures is directly correlates with and downstream from rent. Just to get a little more specific.
So are you a Henry Georgist then, ultimately?
It's kind of too late, right? So Vienna can pull this off because they did have these Henry Georgists who, you know, bought a lot of land when they could. yes, it's just, what does that even mean in 2026, given all the givens, right? But I think there's tremendous potential to land value taxation for.
Well, I know we're almost out of time, and I'll leave Dan with the last question, but I'd say two recommendations for listeners. Mike Bird of The Economist has a new book out called The Land Trap, where, yeah, he gets into some of the Georgists and discusses this, but he ultimately argues that that fiat currencies, to tie it back into capitalism, that fiat currencies are ultimately backed by land. Hence, we got, after the end of the gold standard in the 1970s and inflation, hence we get the land appreciation that leads to our housing crises today. So that we have this sort of negative Georgist thing happening. But then also, I was thinking too, to your point there about the spirituality of it. I'm in the midst of my annual re-listening to my favorite limited edition podcast series of all time, Hell on Earth, by the Chapo Boys, about the 30 Years' War and the Reformation, and about how capitalism emerged from feudalism. And to their point there, it's the Calvinist Dutch who are the ones inventing the social practices and institutions to create capitalism. So maybe Amsterdam and Copenhagen, and then you also get Wren in London because it's the English in the 17th century who produced this. And right before the Glorious Revolution in 1688 that leads to the modern state, we also get the modern city planning. So I don't know, things I'm going to ruminate on there too, but yeah.
I love it. Just super quickly, there's an exercise I like to do to kind of illustrate this point of how unwieldy the future has been. In any given moment in the last 300 years, if you put someone in a time machine, you send them back 10, 20 years, and you have them describe the future, they'll be the first ones to be laughed out of a room of very serious people, right? Send you back to 2012 to tell people about Trump's elections, they would not take you seriously. There's a great version of that. If you go back to, even early 20th century, and you tell people in the left that Karl Marx and not Henry George would be the figure around which people organize their politics, they'd call you insane. Henry George was a much, much bigger deal than Karl Marx until after the Russian Revolution. So anyway, just lots more on all that, but just as a little.
Future is always unpredictable, and the march of time is inexorable, and we have hit one of those walls here, but we are very grateful to have had Bruno Carvalho with us today. He is the author of The Invention of the Future, A History of Cities in the Modern World. And we'll put in the show notes a good deal of the other literature that got suggested in this program. Always great to have these conversations and speculate about past futures and future pasts. Thanks so much, Bruno, for being on Unfrozen.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me. But each day is hidden.